Feeling better? Looking better? Making life better? It's Life Tips. We'll explore the latest innovations, introduce you to the latest products, and bring you the tips from experts and environmental pioneers to help you lead a better life. Life Tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, wiser. Here are your hosts.
Welcome back to the Life Tips Show. I'm here with Lissa. Lissa, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm so delighted to be here.
We're excited to talk with your latest book, which released on December 29th, 2015, for those of you that are 20 years ahead of us now and listening back to these podcasts. Your book is The Anatomy of a Calling, A Doctor's Journey from the Head of Heart and a Prescription for Finding Your Life's Purpose. Thanks for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Right on. You know, first of all, you're the author of 5 books. What was the focus of this latest book? By the way, the second book you published within 1 year. What was the purpose of this book? What was your goal?
You know, I was trained as a conventional doctor, and I quit my job in 2007, which was a very confusing decision and very traumatic decision. And the whole story of why I quit my job as a doctor at 36 years old is told in The Anatomy of a Calling. But really, when I was in that, you know, Charles Eisenstein calls it the space between stories, where the story of Lissa as a doctor had ended, and I had no idea what the next story was, and I was in that really uncomfortable space between stories, and I felt really lost, really like, what is my calling? Why am I here? I thought my calling was to be a doctor, and I was called to medicine the way, you know, priests are called to the priesthood. It was sort of a spiritual mission when I was a little girl. So I felt very confused. And I think there are a lot of people out there that get called into industries of service, you know, like the legal profession or teaching or politics. And they find themselves inside of a system that has become so corrupt that they feel like their calling has betrayed them. So my intention for writing this book really was to create a roadmap for people who might be on a journey. I use the framework of Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey as a map for people who are in the process of waking up to their calling and finding the courage to say yes to the instructions that they get. So really, it's, you know, it's a memoir, so it's me and my story, but really it's about you and your story, so that wherever you are in your journey towards, you know, bringing your love and your gifts into the world in your own unique way, you'll be able to sort of track, oh, here's where I am, so that you can normalize what that part of the journey is like, and then each chapter ends with a hero's guidepost and a hero's practice. So it's actually meant to not only help you locate where you are on your journey, but to facilitate movement to the next phase of the journey with as much inner peace as possible, given that, you know, every hero's journey is an adventure. You know, people who have just watched the new Star Trek, you know, the Star Trek movies are based very much on Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And so there's no way to have the hero's journey be always easy, but there is a way, I believe, to have it be peaceful at the core. And so that was sort of my intention. I wrote the book that I needed back in 2007.
What's wrong with the medical practice that did not seem to align with your newly rejuvenated purpose in life?
There's such a long answer to that. I'll try to soundbite it, but it doesn't soundbite easily. I can speak to my own experience, which is that I sort of come from that almost shaman architect of the true healer. And many of the doctors that I know share that same archetype of, we were genuinely called to service, and there is a certain type of soul that is drawn to that kind of deep service. But the problem I found myself in is when I started my medical practice in 1999, I was expected to see 25 patients a day. And by the time I quit, I was expected to see 40 patients a day, which means I was double booked in 15-minute slots. So I had 7.5 minutes with my patients. And I knew that I had so much more to offer my patients, and it was absolutely impossible to do it within the time constraints. And I would take these 72-hour call shifts where I would be delivering 25 babies in a weekend, and it just became a factory. Personally, like, the part of medicine that I most love is the intimacy, the privilege of being on the front line of life and death, of being the first person to hold somebody's baby or the person who is there holding someone's hand when they die. And that deep intimacy of being invited, you know, onto the front line of these important transformational experiences in somebody's life, whether it's a cancer diagnosis or, you know, an infertility journey or, you know, delivering somebody's baby. And yet that intimacy, it's really hard to fully honor that experience when you're constantly rushed through a system that has become corrupt in many ways. And so for me, it was a feeling of violating my soul's integrity. Like every day that I went to work, I knew that there was a way that I could be practicing. I didn't know what that way was. I came to discover that. But I knew that what I was doing wasn't it, and that in some way I was selling my soul for the comfort and security and status of a well-paid, stable job that has a lot of respect in our culture. And yet the integrity violation led me to, you know, a deep depression. I was taking 7 medications for a whole host of chronic health conditions. And then I went through a series of tragedies and losses, and the whole kit and caboodle just really pushed me over the edge to question everything. And like I said, I don't think it's just me. I think we are in a time of such a transformation, such a shift in consciousness in our culture, that there are a lot of people that are visioning a new way in many industries. And it's this new consciousness is bringing in the vision of what would it look like to practice medicine with love, to practice love with medicine on the side. Or, like I said, it's not just medicine. What would it look like to practice love in the education system, or to practice love in the legal system, or to practice love in corporate America? And so people who are of that inclination are finding it very difficult to stay within the systems without that feeling of violating one's own soul integrity. And so it's creating a big kind of upheaval for a lot of people, where they're in that same inquiry that I was in of, do I stay or do I go? My calling, I thought I was called to be a teacher, and now that I'm in the system, I feel like I'm not able to bring my love to my students in the way that I know they need, for example.
Change is difficult and often impossible, and change comes with consequences. Are you at all worried that by encouraging people to follow their passion and follow their love, that you could have a small revolution on your hands of people that are pursuing things they're passionate about and not doing a job that needs to be done?
Am I worried? That thrills me, what you just said.
That's fun.
I think that, like, what would happen? What would have to happen to our culture? You said something important. You said, you know, doing a job that has to be done. There's a certain assumption in that. There's an assumption that somebody has to sell their soul and do something they hate, because society needs people to self-sacrifice or to relinquish their attachment to their passion or whatever. So there's an assumption in there that says, oh, we would be wreaking havoc if everybody was following their calling, which, to me, I separate callings and passion. And very often they are the same thing. But I personally prefer the word passion, or calling to passion, because I know there are many times, like I was just talking to my roommate this morning, because I just this morning got a call to service in a way that it will require some self-sacrifice. But if I say yes to this calling, I will do so with tremendous gratitude for the opportunity to serve in this way. So I'm not saying everybody is going to go out and be hedonists and just follow their pleasure while ignoring the needs of their neighbors and a culture and Mother Earth. That's not what I'm saying at all. Huh. I think callings come in the form of a certain kind of spiritual guidance that comes from the heart and is very deep and pure, and it can be trusted. And not only can it be trusted to guide the individual, I believe that that kind of revolution, if we had suddenly a culture of people following the guidance of their hearts, I think it would revolutionize the culture in a way that we can't even begin to imagine what that would look like, but that's the part that gets me really excited.
Hmm. I have a nice, simple, easy question for you. What is our purpose in life? And I know that's impossible to answer, but I wanted to ask it to you in terms of the obligation that we have, A, to ourselves, and B, to the people around us that support us in our goals.
I think every individual needs to answer that question for themselves, but I'll answer it for me, which is I believe that every day we have many, many opportunities to choose love in small ways. Like, finding your calling does not have to be some grand thing. It doesn't mean you need to be writing books or starting a nonprofit or volunteering overseas. It can be choosing love in the grocery store when you see somebody in need and you stop to tend to their needs. It can be quitting your job to stay home with your sick grandmother. There are, I think, so many opportunities every day where we see opportunities. We're blind to it many times, but even when we do see them, so often we don't choose to follow that calling to serve love because we have so much armor and our culture doesn't really support it. I think that's our purpose. I think if on your deathbed you can look back and you can say, I chose love, that you will have a very noble purpose.
Who has influenced you most in the big decision like this that you made in your life to move out of medicine?
The person who has influenced me most is Rachel Naomi Remen, but I didn't meet her until right after I quit my job. So I would say when I quit my job, I didn't have any mentor. That's why I think I wrote this book. I felt so lost. I didn't have a therapist or a spiritual counselor or a pastor or a doctor that was modeling the way for me. I was really lacking a mentor. And so I think part of the reason that I wrote this book is because I think mentorship is so important when you're in this transformational journey of waking up to your calling. I was blessed, however, and this story, it's kind of a magic story. The Anatomy of a Calling is filled with magic stories or my sort of mystical experiences. But one of them was, well, I won't tell the whole story because it's long, but in 2008, a year after I'd quit my job, I heard a little voice when I was in Big Sur that said, you need to go to Esalen. You're supposed to meet somebody there. And I had never heard of Esalen Institute, and I was not used to hearing little voices. But long story short, after looking up Esalen online and deciding that this is where crazy people go, and this is really not for me, this is like a strange, weird place, I found myself there, and somebody asked me, why are you here at Esalen? And I said, I don't know, I'm supposed to meet somebody here. And this stranger said, you're supposed to meet Rachel Naomi Remen. And I'd never heard of her. And I said, well, is she here? And she said, no, but she was. And I wound up reading Rachel's book, Kitchen Table Wisdom, which 4 million people have read. She's now a 78-year-old doctor, and she had written a book back in the 90s. And so I read this book, and I ended up signing up for a workshop that she was teaching just to doctors in 2008. And Rachel came up to me at the workshop and invited me to join a circle of doctors that sit in a circle at her house once a month. And so I've been going to that circle for 8 years now, and she's now like my adopted mother. And she created a program called The Healer's Art, which is taught in 70-something medical schools in 9 different countries around the world, teaching medical students how to bring love back to medicine. So she's been an incredible influence on me and my calling and continues to be.
Makes perfect sense. Important to have that, I'm sure, and particularly when it comes to transformation. Tell us a little bit about Hero's Journey, a concept from Joseph Campbell that is obviously very meaningful to you. Tell us about Hero's Journey.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because the Hero's Journey, you know, from Joseph Campbell, one of the influences that Rachel had on me is that Joseph Campbell was one of her teachers when she took a program that they ran for doctors back in the 70s at Esalen. So she actually got her Hero's Journey, you know, experience direct from the master. But Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey has been written up in a book that he wrote, A Hero with 1,000 Faces, and then it was sort of reconfigured into a book called The Writer's Journey, which is a wonderful book that teaches how to use the hero's journey for writing adventure stories and, you know, blockbuster movies and such. So this framework is based on mythology and sort of the human story back through the culture. And essentially it starts with the hero or heroine is in the ordinary world, like not knowing that they have this hero inside. And I really do believe that all of us have a hero inside. And the first thing that happens is that there's a call to adventure. The first thing the hero does is refuse the call. Because usually the call to adventure, and for those of you who are listening, I know that some of you know what I'm talking about because you've heard the call to adventure. And it's really normal, it's really natural for the first response to be a refusal of the call. And I know because when I got my call to adventure, I was like, oh no, I can't do this. Call somebody else. And that's really common, is that initial refusal of the call. So when the hero has been called and is refusing the call, what often happens is the meeting of the mentor. The magical mentor appears. For me, this was Rachel, right at the time where I had heard the call and I was saying no. Rachel entered my life, and the mentor then helps the hero cross the threshold from the ordinary world into the special world. This is where the part in the movie where all of a sudden, you know, things become technicolor and everything starts to be different. The rules are different in the special world. Huh. And in that new world, the hero meets allies and enemies. There are tests on the road of trial as the hero approaches the innermost cave. And this is the part where the forces of light and darkness really come together. And if the hero is brave enough to really face up to those challenges that happen in the innermost cave, and this is the part where often the hero is alone with the forces of darkness, but if the hero can survive that transformative journey, then the hero is given the reward, the Holy Grail. And the hero is then tempted to keep the Holy Grail for himself or herself because they've earned it. But the ultimate hero's journey is to then take that Holy Grail back to the ordinary world to share with those who are just like the hero was that which has been well earned. And so there's the road back, and there's more challenges, and there's usually another death and resurrection just before the ordinary world receives the hero with the Holy Grail back into, you know, bringing the culture upwards as a sort of evolutionary journey. And this is a very common experience for anybody who's been through a hero's journey, whether it's finding and fulfilling your calling or a health experience or losing a loved one or going through a divorce. You know, all of us go through these kinds of hero's journeys that are deep challenges to our status quo and our comfort. And the process is a continual one. So it's not as if the hero comes home with the Holy Grail and is now done and gets to rest on his laurels. We may be called on hero's journeys, multiple different journeys all at one time. So we may be at one phase on the journey in our professional life, and we may be just hearing the call to adventure in a new romance, or we may be, you know, have already gotten the Holy Grail in our family life, but we're just at the beginning of the call to adventure in our professional life. So it's very common that there are multiple hero's journeys going on at the same time.
Tell us about your forces of darkness. What were you battling against?
Well, there's a whole chapter that I was really scared to publish in The Anatomy of a Calling because my forces of darkness were all an inner journey. You know, in the movies, it's often the Darth Vader, right? It's the outer villain. But in my case, and I run a mentorship program for people who are on their own journey, and so I can say it's not just me. It's very often that the forces of darkness are actually inner villains. And there's a very vulnerable chapter in this book that essentially talks about, you know, how my ego operates, how I have been my own worst enemy, how I've created my own suffering, how I've, you know, created unnecessary obstacles on my own journey to finding and fulfilling my calling, as well as in my personal life. And, you know, when I had a mentor read this book, you know, she was like, wow, I don't know that you necessarily want to make that public. But part of that inner journey was, you know, really letting go of the shame of my own vulnerabilities, like being willing to be truthful about my inner villains without making up a story that says it makes me a bad person. Like, I'm doing the best that I can, and we're all, I think, doing the best that we can. I have a name for my inner villain. I call her Victoria Rochester. And the whole story of Victoria Rochester is an adventure story in and of itself, and it's in the book, so I won't tell the whole story.
Do you ever want to meet Victoria Rochester?
Oh, I have met her many times. I have been in therapy for 10 years. I have a spiritual counselor now that I work with for, 4 hours every 2 weeks. So I've had to make peace with Victoria. She's not going to go away. But instead of being in the driver's seat of the wheel of Lyssa, my intention is to have her safely strapped into the car seat in the back, because emotionally she's about 7, even though she likes to act kind of like this diva. She is sort of my wounded child, and so she's not somebody that I need to reject. She's somebody that I just need to love and have compassion for, but also set boundaries with and keep somewhat contained so that she doesn't run amok with the wheel of Lyssa. And sometimes she still gets the wheel, and I'm like, oh, good Lord, there she is. She's going running amok again. And it can be embarrassing or, shaming even, self-shaming. But I think that willingness to go into one's own shadow and to really split through the self-delusion and just come face-to-face with truth without making yourself wrong, just to be willing to see what's true, all of a sudden, a whole lot of light can get through.
I asked you what your forces of darkness are. What is your holy grail? What is the holy grail for you?
Oh, see, you're asking me all the like spoiler alerts. The second to the last chapter tells what my holy grail, what I thought my holy grail was. And then the last chapter says, okay, I thought I was done. I thought, girl gets called on an adventure, girl goes on a hero's journey, girl finds the grail, girl takes it home, right? And that's where the second to last chapter ends. And the last chapter is like, oh my God, I was looking for the wrong grail.
Got it.
So,
well, let's save it. Let's save it for the listeners.
Okay. I'll give you a hint. I'll say the first grail was related to how to practice medicine in a way that felt completely aligned with my soul. And I now run a training program for doctors and other healthcare providers called the Whole Health Medicine Institute. So the first one was related to the content of how to be a really good healer. And the second one was a spiritual holy grail. I'll leave a little suspense.
Let's take a break, everybody. Back in just a minute.
Life Tips will be right back after this short break.
Hey, this is Danny Sullivan to talk to you about Bruce Clay Incorporated. They've made Inc. Magazine's list of growing private businesses and have exhibited and sponsored at my conferences since the very beginning. You've seen their search engine relationship chart, or you've read their SEO code of ethics, so you know they're SEO experts. But did you know they can help you with PPC, web analytics, web design, marketing strategy, promotion, and branding? Yep, get everything you need for success in the online marketplace. You can check it out from the professionals at Bruce Clay Incorporated. For over 10 years with offices worldwide, they've got the answers you need. Check them out today at BruceClay.com.
Oh yeah, my day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
InternetMarketingNinjas.com is the online dojo of the highly trained and skilled Internet Marketing Ninjas. Disavow documents, reconsideration requests, Panda and Penguin penalties. Let our superior SEO ninjas confront all of your link-related issues. The Internet Marketing Ninjas are equipped to master any marketing exercise, content creation, authorship, link building, PPC, and more. Plus, build more buzz for your brand with our social media marketing strategy. Discover all that the Internet Marketing Ninjas can do for you. Visit the online dojo now at InternetMarketingNinjas.com.
Internet Marketing, Inc. designs fully integrated digital programs that improve brand experiences and grow businesses through valuable data insights and strategy across all types of media. Paid, owned, and earned. Their digital experts nimbly adapt strategy by providing you a comprehensive view of your brand's online audience and program performance. If you are looking for a data-driven approach to online marketing and advertising, call Internet Marketing, Inc. today at 866-563-0620 or visit internetmarketinginc.com.
And now back to Life Tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, and wiser. Here are your hosts.
Welcome back, Lisa. It's been great chatting with you on the phone today.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I want to go back, if I could, just to get your take on where medicine has maybe gone wrong and how this transformation relates to you, of course. Do you really think that, for example, pharmaceutical companies that are just wanting to keep us around forever and feed off of this human desire to be alive forever, yet despite the meaning of our lives and the quality of our lives might be so low at certain stages of our life, do you see that as an inherent problem when you think about life and your own life and the mission that you're on right now?
My personal activism is to focus my attention at the level of the healer-patient relationship. And that requires a certain amount of truth and reconciliation. Because one of the things that I discovered when I was out on my book tour for one of my books called Mind Over Medicine, often when I was speaking to a room that was pretty equally mixed with doctors and nurses and conscious, empowered patients and alternative medicine providers. And what I realized is that everybody in the room had been traumatized by doctors, including the doctors, and that in order to repair that very fragile and very precious bond between the healer and the patient and between the healthcare provider team itself, everybody needed to have their, you know, post-traumatic stress addressed and healed, sort of in that truth and reconciliation way that was really beautifully demonstrated in South Africa, in post-apartheid South Africa. So a lot of what I'm really, my personal activism, is what does it mean to go back to that original choice, that original calling that brings a healer to medicine and that brings a patient to a healer? There's a level of trust and a level of intimacy that's required in order to facilitate true healing for the patient. And in Mind Over Medicine, I wrote about the scientific proof that the body can heal itself and what is necessary in order to activate the body's natural self-healing mechanisms. So I believe that this kind of activism is not just about repairing the system. It's actually about curing cancer, about reversing heart disease. Like, there's actually an end result on the patient when this particular bond is healed.
I have about 100 questions that I could ask on that last comment alone. But I want to ask you this. I've always believed, you know, having battled cancer myself and, you know, gone through lots of struggles with divorce and having a child move away from a particular area I was living in and all kinds of challenges like that, I sort of prescribe to this thought. I want to run it by you as it relates now to where I am with my own family and also thinking about my own life as I move forward. And it's this concept of, you know, when we love our life, we can let it go to find its way. But when we're selfish about our life, we demand more from it. We want more. Do you prescribe to this type of thinking? Do you have a compass like that, a GPS that helps you understand how we think about our own lives? And I'm particularly related to how this relates to this problem that I see with, you know, pumping drugs into us, which really should not be happening if we don't have quality of life.
Well, I think the pumping of drugs is because as individuals in this culture, and it's specific to our culture, this is not this way around the world. I've spent time living in a village at 16,000 feet in the Andes in Peru. This is not like this in the Andes in Peru. But in our culture, we have a certain resistance to confronting those inner demons that we can only find in the innermost cave of our hero's journey. So many of us would rather take a pill than come face to face with the truth of who we are and how we're making our choices. And I have a particular worldview that, you know, I can't prove it. It's just a worldview. But I personally believe that everything that's happening to us in our lives is, on some level, our soul has chosen it as part of our evolution as a soul. I love Rob Bresny, I think, coined the term pronoia, which is the opposite of paranoia. It's the unshakable faith that, everything in the universe is conspiring to shower you with blessings. Now, it's really hard to talk to somebody about pronoia when they've just been diagnosed with cancer or when their loved one has just been beheaded by ISIS, when it looks like everything around them is falling apart. And I don't have the time to make my case for why I believe in pronoia. I actually made my case in my last book, The Fear Cure. Because for me, pronoia is part of the antidote to fear. It's when you believe that even your challenges are a gift that your soul has chosen to participate in as a way to learn resilience or discernment or compassion, you know, or some of these really deep spirit or humility, you know, some of these deep spiritual lessons. And I certainly, that's my frame of my own life. My last 2015 was just a brutal year for me, if Victoria judges it. But if my soul looks at it, I can see tremendous growth through five people that I love dying, through two breakups, through some financial struggles, all happening all at the same time. But, you know, I think that worldview, it makes me kind of bulletproof, because even in the middle of five funerals within 6 weeks, I was able to see the blessing of my cracked open heart in that deep vulnerability of pure grief, and recognizing that when I let myself feel all the way into the grief of that, what I was met with was the unconditional love at the ground of being, that it was only my resistance. The story that said most of these people were in their 30s, the story that said these people should not be dying, something is wrong with life. But my mantra at the ringing in of the new year in 2016 was, I am in agreement with life and I resist nothing.
Huh. Do you have any examples of coming face to face with our challenges, not just your own, but maybe some other people's as well? Of course, your own would be great. But how do we come face to face with our challenge? How do we meet, greet, and do away with those challenges? What are examples?
Well, I don't think we do away with them. That's part of it. We don't do away with them. We go all the way into them. I think we try to skip them. You know, and even in spiritual circles, you see this whole kind of spiritual bypassing where people are now trying to use meditation, for example, to ascend above the painful dynamic of being human. And I don't think that's the solution. I think, you know, for example, when I was in the middle of losing five people that I love, I noticed that I would have these contractions of my heart. It was almost like labor pains in my heart. I had heart pain. At first, I thought I was having a heart attack. And then I realized, this is a heartbreak. My heart is breaking. You know, I was trained as an OBGYN, so I was like, well, if I'm having contractions of my heart, then maybe I just need to apply the same advice I would have given a laboring woman, which is that when you're having uterine contractions, like something is trying to be born through you, right? So these contractions are purposeful. And if you fight the labor contractions, you actually make the pain worse and you can obstruct the labor by fighting the contractions. And the only way to handle it is to soften into the pain, to like relax into the contraction. It's so counterintuitive because what you feel like doing is bracing against the pain. But it actually makes the pain worse. And I think that's what so many of us do in the face of life challenges. We brace against the pain, or we try to skip it, or we, you know, use substances or take drugs, you know, pharmaceutical drugs or other drugs, or we, you know, try to skip it with busyness, filling our life with more and more stuff and more experiences so that we're not sitting in silence and meditation to actually digest, wow, that happened. But what I realized in the middle of that heartbreak is that if I just let myself feel it, if I just softened into the pain, the heart contraction only lasted about 90 seconds. And I could just sit there and hold myself and cry if I needed to. It would let go. And then there would be another one. And in the beginning, they came pretty close together. And over time, they started spacing out. So I think that's why I came to that mantra of, I am in agreement with life and I resist nothing, that it's the resistance to life's challenges perhaps that causes the greatest psychic pain or physical pain in this case, And that when we're actually brave enough to just meet whatever happens without making it wrong, then something relaxes. And like I said, the shocking thing for me was to realize that when I softened into the pain, what I was met with was love. And it felt very similar. And some of you who have been to funerals or really lost a loved one or heartbreak in a romance, you know that if you go all the way into grief, at the base of it, if you don't resist it, at the base of grief, you realize that deep grief and joy are like sitting right next to each other. That the only reason it hurts that much is because you loved that much. And I, for one, am not willing to stop loving that much, even if it means that I'm going to go through more heart contractions in my life. One of the things I talk about in The Anatomy of a Calling is giving people permission to break your heart.
Huh. I feel as if I should pause for about 15 minutes, by the way, in thinking about everything you just said there, Lisa. But I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I have two final questions for you. Who would you like to get a hold of you, and how can they get a hold of you?
Well, I would love to have people get a hold of me when they are ready, when they are ready for deep transformation. And I say that because one of the things Rachel Naomi Remen taught me is you can't force a rosebud to blossom by beating it with a hammer. So I'm not looking for the people that aren't ready to blossom. I'm too confronting for those people. If people want to stay comfortable in their fear-based worldview, then I'm not a good fit. I'll just trigger people. But for people that are really, really deeply ready to take the next step, to say yes to the call to adventure, then I would love to have people follow me on Facebook or sign up for my blog at lissarankin.com. I send out a daily email called The Daily Flame, which is messages from your inner pilot light. They're sort of love letters from your soul to your ego, and that's at innerpilotlight.com. And I've created a free gift that's at theanatomyofacalling.com, which is the book's website. And there's a Fulfill Your Calling kit that's filled with guided meditations that I created with musician Karen Drucker, as well as a PDF offering more tools about finding and fulfilling your calling. It's a ton of content, and it just stems from my deep desire to facilitate this transformational shift in consciousness, not just at the level of the individual, but at the level of the culture. And I don't want people to feel like they have to buy my book in order to get that, so I created a lot of free content that people can use in case they can't afford to buy the book. Lots of ways to be in touch.
Lisa, once again, fantastic to have you as a guest on the show. Thanks much.
Oh, thank you so much, Byron. It was a pleasure.
Indeed. I hope everybody, for me as well, by the way, I hope everyone is a little bit smarter, better, faster, and more heroic in your approach through your journey. And hopefully Lisa helped a lot. I'm sure she did. And we'll see you next week, everybody, for another great Life Tip Show. Thanks for tuning in.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.